And this is the last entry on our 5-year consolidated plan and 2018 action plan for housing and community development for Metro Nashville. I'm Angie Hubbard, and I'm the Director of Community Development, and I'll be leading tonight's public hearing. So I'm going to start with just an overview of what we're going to cover tonight. Welcome and some housekeeping. So I want to make sure that everyone has signed in at the front table. There should be 2 pieces of materials. Sue, did you get them out of my bag? There's a sheet that looks like this, and then a copy of the slides. Good deal. Thank you. And so we're going to go over the 5-year plan, what its purpose is, how it's organized. We'll go over some very high-level highlights, and then we're going to talk about the priorities for the next 5 years. Then we're going to dive into what we're planning for 2018, the purpose of this year one action plan, our funding that we've received, and then what our activities and goals are for the year. And then at that time, I'll go over public participation, how you can submit your comments. And then when I get through with my presentation, I'll open it up for questions and official comments. I do ask to let me please get through my presentation before you ask any questions, so please note them on a slide or a piece of paper, and we'll make sure. And we won't leave here until if you've got a question or comment, we've heard it and can respond if we can here. If not, we'll follow up with a written response. So what is the 5-year consolidated? Oh, and let me add, we do have someone here that does for sign language interpretation. If anyone is hearing impaired, if you need any service. Okay. So the purpose of our 5-year consolidated plan is, first, we have to prepare this because Nashville receives 4 direct grants from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The Community Development Block Grant, and that's a pretty flexible grant that can do anything from housing rehab to public service programs to infrastructure projects to economic development projects. And the only thing we cannot do with CDBG is build new housing. No new housing in CDBG. The Home Investment Partnerships Program is strictly for affordable housing construction or rehab. We choose, as we'll talk later, that we are only going to use it for new construction, and we'll talk about why. And rental housing funded through the Home Program benefits households that have incomes at or below 60% of the area median income. And homeownership is for households at 80% of the area median income. Then we have our Emergency Solutions Grant, the ESG program. And this program is solely for addressing homelessness. And then our 4th one is Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS. And that provides housing and supportive services assistance for persons with AIDS or their family and their families. We have to prepare a 5-year plan to describe how we're going to use these funds to address housing and community development needs. And this 5-year consolidated plan covers the period of June 1st, 2018, so technically our program year starts tomorrow, and it goes through May 31st of 2023. The reason we're late with getting the plan out is HUD issued a notice in January that told grantees that you cannot submit your consolidated plan or action plans until HUD issues the notice of allocations for 2018. As if you're not familiar, Congress did not pass the budget timely to go into effect on October the 1st of 2017, and they did 2 continuing resolutions, and finally a budget was passed in March, and so HUD told us on May the 1st how much money the city of Nashville was going to get for the 4 grant programs. So we wanted to present an action plan with actual instead of estimates so that the public knows the real dollars we're receiving. compliant with the notice, and HUD has approved our submittal of the action plan by July 31st of 2018. So any cost incurred as of June 1st, or actually at the conclusion of the public comment period, we'll be able to incur. So it's organized according to a template that HUD gives us. So if you've seen the document online and all the questions we have to answer, those are from HUD. We couldn't make this up if we tried. It is organized into the following sections: an executive summary that gives a high-level overview, a discussion of the process, and that is all of our citizen participation efforts, the needs assessment, and we do we looked at housing needs, homeless needs, needs for special, non-homeless special populations like persons with disabilities, our HAWQA clients, and we looked at non-housing community development, which are things like public facilities needs like parks or sidewalks. All of those are required to be assessed in our consolidated plan. Then we follow up with a market analysis. So first we've looked at need, now we look at supply in terms of in these same areas. And so we take what we find in the needs assessment and the market analysis, as well as all the information we obtained through public input, and we came up with a strategic plan that outlines the priorities of the consolidated plan. The purpose of the 2018 act, or then at the end, following the consolidated plan, we have the 2018 action plan. Then we have appendices and exhibits that are referred to in both documents. Well, they're actually part of one document. So just an overview of the process. How did we craft this consolidated plan? So first, HUD gave us data. There's lots of data tables in the consolidated plan. So that drove a lot of the needs assessment and the market analysis. We looked at other plans and reports that have especially been done locally, like the Housing Nashville report, Nashville Next, community needs evaluation. We wanted to build on other efforts in the city because this, after all, this plan is the city's plan. We didn't want to duplicate, and where work has already been done, we wanted to utilize it. And we wanted to align with those initiatives that have come out in those plans and reports. We had a work group that was composed of key staff members from the Mayor's Office, Metro Homelessness Commission, Metro Social Services, Metro Human Relations Commission, the Housing Fund, and MDHA staff, and did I forget one? I think that's it. And then we had seven community meetings. These were open to the public. They were announced via emails and social media and flyers. We had seven of these meetings. We had stakeholder consultations that were topic specific, such as on homelessness, on affordable housing, on non-housing community development, on HAWQA. We had 13 stakeholder meetings. So between the community meetings and the stakeholder consultations, approximately 84 agencies were represented, nonprofit, for-profit, state, local, and federal agencies all participated, and over 200 people came, 181 or so were unduplicated, so some people came more than once. We also issued a survey from March the 16th to April 13th, and we received 201 responses. And then the final piece are the public hearings. We had a public hearing to kick off the consolidated plan process with the public on March the 1st and introduced everyone to the process and how we were going to obtain input. We are now in the public comment phase. It is open until 4 o'clock p.m. on June the 7th. And this is our fourth and final public hearing on the consolidated plan and the action plan. So thank you for coming out and parking on the street. So first I'm going to start with some high-level overviews of the needs assessment. I want to talk first about the data that's in the consolidated plan. HUD gave us default data, so all the tables that are in the consolidated plan that are labeled, that have a table number, those are HUD tables. And they gave us the 2009 to 2013 American Community Survey five-year estimates. And some tables have 2009, 2013 Community Housing Affordability Strategy data. It's called the CHAPS. Both of these are a bit dated. And so where we could, we supplemented with the 2012-2016 ACS five-year estimates and the 2010-2014 CHAS, that's the most recent CHAS data. HUD on their data, they filter the CHAS data different ways for their tables. So some of the information that we were able to get through the census data and the CHAS didn't translate exactly. So we created supplemental tables underneath HUD tables to tell the story a different way. I don't think that the story's not changed at all. It's just supplemented. You can show data about three different ways and come up with everybody's cost burden in Nashville. So our big high-level needs assessment, I don't think that will come to a shock to anybody, is that and the HUD baseline data that was provided to us was from 2000. So the median income for a household of four from over 16 years grew from a little over 39,000 to a little over 50,000. During the same time, the percent of individuals living in poverty, however, increased from 13% to 17.7%. So there's some discrepancies that are happening. The most common housing burden, I mean, there's a lot of data tables that gets us to this one point that's been discussed for several years now. The most common housing problem in Davidson County is cost burden, and that's for all income ranges. Cost burden means that a household is paying more than 30% of their gross income on housing costs. But when we look at very low income, at 0 to 30% of the area median income, severe cost burden is the most common housing problem for renters and homeowners in this income bracket, and severe cost burden means that they're paying more than 50% of their income for housing costs. And that is consistent with all the other reports that have come out in the city. So I've got a market analysis table that I wanted to share with you. One of the things that we were asked to do is look at local, state, and federal resources that could be used to address the housing and community development needs in Davidson County that we identified during the needs assessment. So we created this table that's by different types of ways to address housing, new construction, for rental or home ownership, rental assistance. We wanted to give the public an opportunity to see what's out there and where the gaps are for assistance. And you'll see in the columns different income categories. The higher, they're listed in the highest income range that will be served. For example, NSP can serve households with incomes up to 120 of the area median income. They can also serve, through that program, incomes that are less. Incomes in the 0 to 60% of the area median income cannot be used to serve people in higher income brackets. So this gives us an idea of where the resources are. The lower the income, the deeper the subsidy that needs to go in to support a project. Here's another highlight from our market analysis. We were asked to look at what's the risk. We've heard a lot about the loss of affordable housing in Nashville. What's at risk with our tax credits and our privately owned project-based rental assistance? These are not the MDHA-owned project-based rental assistance that we've converted to under RAD. These are privately owned. During our five-year period, we are at risk of losing over 4,000 existing low-income housing tax credit or privately owned PVRA units because their contracts have either expired or their compliance period has expired, or they can opt out of their contract, so they can actually sell now that property to any developer, and it can it will no longer be affordable. We don't know that this will happen. We just had a developer come through and re-up a PBRA that just expired with some tax credits. But this helps us really hone in on making sure that we try to preserve these units and what our risk is. So here are some tables from our market analysis. The first one just shows the change in the cost of housing over 16 years. A 56% increase in the median home value in Davidson County, and a 43% increase in median contract rents. And the second table just gives you an idea of where the population falls and the amount of rent paid. With 60% of tenants in Davidson County paying between $500 and $999. The third table on housing affordability really reflects what we talked on the previous slide about cost burden. Only 7% of renters with incomes at 30% or below the area median income, here HAMFI, H-A-M-F-I means the same thing as area median income, can afford their housing. There's no data for homeowners in this income range, likely because we don't see many homeowners in this income range. Even at 50% of the area median income, only 25% of renters and 10% of homeowners can afford their housing. So we use all of that to build
that,
out.
Okay. That's just a mortgage, that's not housing, upkeep, and all that. Right?
That is a housing affordability, so that's
rent.
Their rent and their payments.
Or the
yes.
Mortgage.
Yes. The strategic plan priorities coming from our market analysis, our needs assessment, and all of our input, and I really went through the needs assessment and market analysis at very high levels, because we're going to focus a lot on the priorities and how we're going to address them. The first one is twofold, and it is to increase the number of decent, safe, affordable units. The second part, and that's building new physical units. The second part is to help low and moderate income households access affordable housing. Here we're talking about addressing housing barriers, particularly for persons with protected characteristics under the Fair Housing Act. The second one is to preserve existing affordable housing units, and that's physical housing stock. But we also want to help low and moderate income households retain their housing, and that's maintain housing stability. The third one is to support facilities and services for the homeless and persons with AIDS. The fourth one is to create pathways to self-sufficiency for low and moderate income persons and families. The fifth one is to revitalize distressed neighborhoods and underserved areas. And a lot of these are very reflective of our findings from our fair housing analysis that we conducted last year. And then the sixth one simply speaks to our responsibilities to undertake grant management planning and other administrative tasks related to our four grant programs. In addition to priorities for housing and community development needs, we've also established geographic priorities on where we want to target these funds. So we've created three geographic priority areas. The first one we refer to as CDBG target areas. There are 26 census tracts, and there's a, we'll show a map here in a minute. There are 26 census tracts in Davidson County where at least 70% of the households have incomes at less than 80% of the area median income. So these are areas with high concentrations of poverty. Our fair housing analysis showed us that these are areas that are not only high concentrations of poverty, there are high correlations that's usually where public housing is located. There are poor performing schools. There's lots of reliance on public transportation. There's not a lot of private investment or public investment. So we selected these census tracts to focus any place-based initiatives for non-housing community development, like infrastructure projects, economic development opportunities, so that we can lift these neighborhoods up. The second one is we're going to focus specifically on the Napier-Sudicum Choice Neighborhoods Planning Area. In 2016, MDHA received a Choice Neighborhoods Planning Grant, And that is to revitalize not only the area of Napier-Sudicum, but the surrounding houses and economic, or the transportation corridor. We are concurrently with this consolidated plan proposing to create a neighborhood revitalization strategy area in this boundary. And then the third one are what we call housing target areas. We've all heard about the gentrification that's happening in Nashville and concerns about displacement. There are 14 council districts in Nashville where at least 40% of, or there are 14 council districts where that saw at least a 40% increase in the property values in that in those since in those districts during the 2017 reappraisal. So we want to target some specific funds, and we'll talk a minute how to help address gentrification that's already happening or could be happening in these areas. And we also included areas in which MDHAM public housing is located. So our first target area map, this is the list of the 26 census tracts. The shaded areas are the CDBG target areas. The areas with the blue dots, that's where public housing is located for our other tracts. And then the green shaded is our Napier-Sudicum strategy area. So you can see we have a cluster in North Nashville. We have a cluster around Bordeaux, West Trinity Lane area. We have a cluster in Madison. We have a couple of tracks down in Antioch, and then along the Lafayette corridor. This is the boundary of the Choice Neighborhood Planning Area. The, if you can see it, I can't tell if you can make out the brown areas in the top left-hand corner. That's where Napier and Sudicum public housing is. You can see that we're touching a much bigger area than just the public housing where MEHA is proposing to revitalize its housing. The green areas are single family homes, a lot of them. You can see the Lafayette corridor cutting through. We border on the Wedgewood-Houston area, which is an up and coming area, so we are focusing initially, the first project is to target homeowner rehab in this area. So there's a lot of blighted single-family homes, so we want to be able to provide assistance to make those homes safe and decent. And we don't want those homeowners to be pushed out as the area revitalizes. So there's twofold for that. In our housing target areas, this is the list of census tracts. In descending order, the top census tract had the highest, almost, it was in the 90s, increase in property values down to 40%. This is just the big council district map. You can see the District 5 is along the Dickerson Road corridor, 21 is North Nashville area. So a lot of, we have a lot of overlay between, it's ironic, we have some of these areas where we've identified the census tracts as very low income, but we're seeing the sharp increase in the home values. And so we know that there's a lot of low and moderate income homeowners that we want them to be able to stay in their homes as these areas start to redevelop, revitalize. So that's why we're targeting with these homeowner rehab programs. We're gonna prioritize some of our home funds. We would like to site new construction here if possible. So we're gonna deploy several tools that we'll talk about in a minute to help address these concerns. So now we get into, well, what do we propose to do in 2018 to address these priorities? Thank you. So our annual update is, every year we have to do an annual update to the consolidated plan. Program year one is 2018, which starts on June 1st. Even though we get these direct formula allocations from HUD, we have to submit this action plan. It serves as our application for CDBG Home, ESG, and HOPWA. we provide actual allocations. We not only talk about how much money we're receiving from HUD, we're going to talk about how we're going to use that money specifically in project budgets. And this covers a period of June the 1st through May 31st of 2019. So this is our resources for the year. We are very pleased to have received $1.3 million more total than we did in 2017. If anybody keeps track of the federal budget, these were all zeroed out in the president's budget. So not only did we get them restored, we have more funding than last year thanks to the lifting spending caps. The biggest, and I'm so pleased to say, was with home. We had around a $690,000 increase in home, which is huge because that is our only source for new construction. A little over $400,000 for CDBG, around $7,000 for ESG, and around $200,000 for HOPLA. Then we get to add program income to that amount, and that's where we've made loans to homeowners, and they've repaid those loans. That recycles back in to programs, and as you can see in our budgets and our action plan, we tell you specifically how we use that. This is huge. I know a lot of people may not be able to see it, but what it is the entire CDBG budget for the program year. The top table is the categories: administration and planning, housing, public services, public facilities and improvement, and economic development. Our administration and planning cannot exceed more than 20% of the grant allocation and the program income. So that stays there. It will never increase. Public services cannot be more than 15% of the grant allocation and program income, and that's at 13%. Housing, historically, we've allocated approximately 35% of CDBG funds for housing activities. We are at 50% in this action plan. Then we have a breakdown with housing, how we propose to use housing, and it's all for rehab, different rehab programs. And I'm going to talk about them in another way and go through them in just a minute. Our CDBG, a list of public services that range everything from summer youth to services for the homeless to fair housing activities. And then we have a Section 108 loan repayment under economic development. It's our last payment for a loan that was obtained in 1998. And then micro enterprise assistance. Our public facilities proposed budget is at the very bottom. This is home. We propose, with home, you cannot use more than 10% of your grant and public and program income for administration. We are very heavy on rental new construction, and that is because we want to target very low income, and as we discussed previously, they typically are not homeowners. So when we look at 0 to 30 or 0 to 60%, it's a rental product, so we are at 70% of our budget. We do have 10% for new construction, as people need to make some affordable homeownership opportunities available. We have a new activity that we're proposing this time. It's called a new nonprofit partner set-aside. We've heard over the years, as the home regulations have become very tight and capacity being increasingly emphasized in our funding opportunities, smaller nonprofits that used to receive funding or smaller nonprofits that are wanting to get into affordable housing aren't often able to compete in our funding opportunities with larger nonprofits or for-profits. So we have proposed a set-aside of approximately $258,000 for nonprofits that have not received home money in the past 5 years and that have completed the Barnes Fund Capacity Building Program. Because capacity is one of the required underwriting and evaluation reviews that we have to undertake for home. We essentially have to operate home like a bank, so we have to look at it very tightly. So we did want to provide our new nonprofit partners with some opportunities to start building capacity and we've elected to do that through this program. So our 2018 ESG and HOPWA budgets, the ESG proposed activities, our rapid rehousing, homeless prevention, shelter operations and essential services, outreach, and HMIS support that's required for ESG. HOPWA, not only does MDHA have a little bit of administration, but our HOPWA partners are able to take some funding for administration. Funding goes to provide short-term rent, mortgage, and utility assistance, facility operations, and support services. So how do we use this money then to address those priorities we just talked about? So here I'm going to lay it out a little differently. So we've sliced these grants in different ways. So what I'm going to show you now is each priority, the funds that are going to be used to address it. So as we go across the rows, and I don't have a pointer, so the activity means the grant program. So it'll be either be HOME, CDBG, ESG, or HOPWA. Whether it's new construction, fair housing activities, then the budget. And that budget includes any program income plus the grant allocation. The five-year budget is that amount times five. We're very comfortable for level funding. I've said it. This is my fourth public hearing where I've said if I put it in writing, maybe it'll stick with Congress. Our proposed goals for the first year, for 2018, to fund, not to complete. It takes about 2 years to build housing, so this is what we hope to award in funding for 50 units in year one. We hope after year five, we've funded the creation of 250 units of new rental. Then we have the target area. So you'll see different target areas for these activities. The HTA means the housing targeted areas. These are our gentrifying areas. This is where we will give first priority for, highest priority for projects. If we don't have viable projects, we will fund these projects countywide, but we really want to make sure that we're preventing displacement where we can. Then the final column is income target. So you can see rental housing is at 60% and everything else is at 80%. So the first one speaks to two different activities. Remember, it's twofold. It's we're going to build new units, and so that's through new construction with three different home activities. And the second one is to help low and moderate income households access affordable housing. And here we're focusing on fair housing activities aimed at reducing barriers to housing, such as housing discrimination, any testing activities that needs to be done for persons with protected characteristics. We found in our fair housing analysis that lower income households typically have some type of protected characteristic, whether it's race, color, national origin, disability. So we really want to focus on eliminating or reducing those housing barriers. We move into our second priority, and this is to retain affordable housing stock, the first part, and that's through a number of CDBG rehab activities. You can see in the target area, we go a lot of places with this. So we're targeting homeowner rehab, a portion of it, in our Napier-Sudicum Choice Neighborhood area. As I mentioned, as we redevelop, we want to retain that affordable housing. The bulk of our money, over $1 million, is going to address housing rehab in the gentrifying areas that I mentioned, those 14 council districts. We have a small amount of CDBG funding proposed to supplement our Department of Energy Weatherization Assistance Program. That actually provides weatherization measures for households at 200% of the poverty level, which equates to about 60% of the area median income. Our allocation for that weatherization assistance program is quite complicated, and we can't fully utilize it because of the health and safety requirements. So this is to supplement that and take it further. We have rental rehab proposed, and these are all, the rental rehab is for a landlord to actually submit an application. We don't do an RFP. If you're a landlord and you want some rental rehab assistance, and it can not only just have to be on the house, it can be site work related, this program's for you. Then we have a program strictly for the replacement of non-functioning HVAC units that is not part of the weatherization. So if you're in the weatherization program, this is separate. You can't apply for this. Then the bottom one is we want homeowners and tenants to be able to stay in their housing, because we know from our analyses that if you are in these lower incomes, or anybody, but really the lower the income, the harder it is to find housing if you lose it. Not only because the supply of affordable housing is slim, but you often have some housing barriers now with an eviction and other things. So we're proposing to mirror something that Metro Social Services has just done on some anti-displacement initiative. We're proposing to fund a renter counseling program for MDHA residents, so that's residents of our housing, that if they're at risk of losing their housing for some kind of a lease issue that's not egregious or veers on the legal side of things, we're proposing this to mitigate loss of housing through different types of issues that can arise for our tenants. Priority three, support facilities and services for the homeless and persons with AIDS. So we have a lot of numbers here. This is based on what we funded in previous years. We went over the ESG and HOPPER programs previously. I do want to showcase that we also have a CDBG program that supports homeless facilities and services. And what that is, it provides first month rent, utility deposits, and rental deposits for persons that find housing either through the Metro Homelessness Commission housing navigation efforts or through the MDHA administered BASH program, which is for veterans, or Shelter Plus Care. And that just helps overcome some of those initial barriers to get our homeless populations into housing. This is one time per client, up to $1,000, and the assistance is paid directly to the landlord or the utility provider.
What's the application process?
Actually, the application process, we award funds to... We partner with MHC and allocate funds to them, and we allocate funds to our rental assistance department. And the housing navigators work with the community to find populations, and we can talk more. We'll take actually questions at the end, but I'll address that. So you have to be working with a housing navigator through MHC, and when we open up for comments, Judy Tackett can address more how that happens, but they actually then use it when that person finds the housing. Same thing with our rental assistance department. If you've applied for a BASH voucher or a Shelter Plus Care voucher and you need that assistance, then our rental assistance department will make that assistance happen for those clients. So it's not a person applies to these organizations for that. You have to be in through another program. So then we're looking at creating pathways to self-sufficiency for low and moderate income persons and families. We all saw how only 7% of people with 0 to 30% of the median income can afford their housing. So we heard a lot through our input that we need some opportunities to help connect people to employment opportunities, to create pathways to self-sufficiency so they can better be able to afford the homes they live in. So we're doing it two ways. One is creating economic opportunities for low and moderate income persons. So whenever we fund a HUD construction project, whenever there's a HUD funded construction project or MDHA construction project, we have to do something that's called a Section 3 plan, or our contractors do. And that means that if a contractor needs to hire someone, they have to give us a plan on how they'll hire a low-income person in the area. And our area is defined as Davidson County. We don't really, the state of Tennessee really doesn't support local hire legislation at the city level, so this is kind of the closest that we can get. So we're partnering with our recapitalization department at MDHA that is overseeing all of our redevelopment efforts that will also help us with our projects we fund to connect residents to these employment opportunities or to workforce development opportunities so they can get the skills. A deficit we have is that the contractors, when they reach out to MDHA for a list of Section 3 qualified individuals or businesses, there are none, or there's one. There's one. And so we have, this is a way that we're connecting, not only building new housing, but providing employment opportunities for low income. So we're in the process of scoping how that will work. And that is a new program that we really want to introduce to create some self-sufficiency opportunities. The other one is micro-enterprise assistance. And I was actually at a meeting earlier this week about how many low and moderate income people that do work have their own business. They work out of their home. They do something. And so this is to support businesses with five or less employees. The owner is low income to get them. And this isn't capital money. This is training and technical assistance funding that would be made available through a partner. We're currently partnering with Pathway Lending, but we're working with the city to redefine how that works so we can target it in specific areas. Again, we're looking to target that in these very low-income areas. So we hear a lot in certain areas of the county, especially where these target areas are, the need for small businesses, community-based businesses. So we want to lift up and rebuilding with community-based businesses and provide these economic opportunities. The second one is to support summer youth programs. We've heard a lot as we go throughout the year, and we attend forums and we read studies and we get our feedback about the need to really engage our youth at a young age on wrapping them with constructive programming to make them successful adults. And our summer youth program has always been defined as a great structured program for academics. We have some that do some STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math programs. These aren't just waste your time arts and crafts. These are really constructive programming. We do require that a provider have offer at least a job skills component or a healthy lifestyle component. And then we also support the city's Opportunity Now program by awarding funding to nonprofits that employ youth ages 14 to 16 in the six week period. This is just of the large Opportunity Now program, which is huge. This is a very micro piece of it. These are community-based projects. So these are some of the ways that we propose to create pathways of self-sufficiency for low and moderate income persons and families. And then priority five, revitalize distressed neighborhoods and underserved areas. And that again speaks to one of our key findings from our Fair Housing Access in disparities in access to opportunities, especially in so if you look at our maps from our fair housing analysis and the maps of these target areas, these are usually racially concentrated, either African American or Hispanic, ethnic or racially concentrated areas of poverty. And so we wanted to start introducing sidewalks to connect people to bus stations. These are small projects. There isn't a lot. This isn't where we put a bulk of our money, but we have heard barriers for people that, again, in these census tracts, they rely heavily on public transportation. If there is a need for a bus stop, these are some of the things we're going to explore after we see each year what the capital spending plan looks like in areas that may not be awarded funding, if we can supplement some projects in these areas. And if our funding does increase over the years, we may do larger projects like, we've heard a lot of conversation about hub centers converting old public buildings, you know, so we'll continue to explore and work with communities on what they identify as some of their priority projects, just to help spur some revitalization efforts or just simply help connect them to a school on a safe sidewalk, to stand under a bus shelter during a storm while they wait on public transportation. So that's what these activities are here for. Then six speaks to just our admin budget for the 2018 year and 5 year, and then our Section 108 loan repayment. So how does this look? So these are how our priorities, our funding lines up. And priority one and two are certainly well over half of our all of our grants combined. And I know most people would think, well, wouldn't priority number one have the greater percentage of funding? Normally, it would. But all of the data, all of the input we've received is that we need more physical affordable housing units. So that's why that is our number one priority. Because we hope that not only does this plan tell the story of what we need to do with our funds, but other people will pick it up, and as they go to a bank, lots of banks have Community Reinvestment Act requirements. They look at what the consolidated plan says for how they make investments. So we put this out there for a wider audience to be able to use this as a tool. So home is our only source to achieve the new construction, so it's not as big of a budget as CDBG, so that's why that's a lesser percentage of the overall funding. The second priority is at 28%. 17% of our combined funding is to address priority three, which is services and facilities for the homeless. Priority four is the pathways to self-sufficiency, and that's at 6%. Priority five on the underserved areas, and that's currently only at 2%. You saw that small $213,000 budget. Priority six is our admin, and then the Section 108 loan payment is separate at 6% right now, and this, after this year, we won't be having that because it is paid. So, how does this look by geography? Remember those three geographic priority areas. So our CDBG target areas, because right now we're only focusing that small amount of infrastructure funding and micro enterprise is 3.4% of the funding. The Napier-Sudicum rehab is at 2.2%. And then our housing target areas, we're really focusing quite a bit of funding on these anti-displacement efforts. And as if you haven't heard, Metro is part of the anti-displacement policy link initiative. So we've got several. We're trying to attack this on several fronts. So how does the public comment on this plan? As I mentioned at the beginning, our public comment period closes at 4 p.m. on June the 7th. One of the ways is through attending a public hearing, and our last one is today. You can submit your comments here at this public hearing. Your comments received today will be summarized, and our responses will be summarized and included in the appendix. You can submit them electronically at consolidatedplan@nashville-mdha.org. You're likely here because you got a ton of emails from me at some point over the past 4 months. Someone today called me their email stalker. This is a good way to also communicate with us if you want to get on our email list. If someone forwarded this to you and you're not on it yourself, we'll actually take your sign-in sheet and add you, so beware. Don't put me in your spam box. You can fax it to us at 615-252-8533. It helps get to us faster on any of these if you put Attention Consolidated Plan. You can mail it. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 846, Nashville, Tennessee 37202. You can hand deliver it to the Community Development Department. Our office closes at 4 p.m. every day. We are located at 712 South 6th Street, and that's in the James Casey Homes. We have a dedicated consolidated plan page, and that is www.nashville-mdha.org/consolidated-plan/. And there we also keep a list of our meetings, a lot of consolidated plan resources. You can see our 2013-2018 action plans. If you scroll all the way down to the bottom, or to the, I think it, we have it divided in pages. But there's a lot of information there. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter and get all sorts of updates on all the wonderful things happening at MDHA at Nashville MDHA. And so I'm going to leave this up for anyone that needs to write this information down if it's too small to read on your slides. And at this point, I am going to open it up for public comments. I ask that, because we have several people here that may want to speak, that we be respectful of everyone's time and giving everyone an opportunity to take the floor. With that, the public hearing is open. Mark.
Okay, well, I'll be respectful and only ask one question.
You can ask as many questions as you want, but
I'll start
you may
with
have
mine.
To take
yeah.
turns.
Okay. Well, the plan looks very good. A pretty good plan. I'm glad you guys have funded and actually put money for housing back into the CDBG. So that was very important, I thought. We have a situation, because we're now talking about 501c3 housing development. And when it comes to the CDBG funds, I know you have for homeowner rehab. Now, I'm assuming that's for the homeowner to apply to MDHA for funds. Now, one thing that we see consistently is we have a lot of, where we develop, homeowners come to us and ask, hey, can you guys help us with our property or mm-hmm. help us rehab? Mm-hmm. Would it be possible for a nonprofit, say there's a homeowner that wants this funding, is it possible for the homeowner to go through the nonprofit and nonprofit apply for the money, the funding for rehab?
We're going to explore different ways to undertake these activities with capacity issues with the amount of contractors, because we still have our 2017 countywide funding.
Right.
So we will explore some ways that our nonprofit can help us, especially in the targeted areas where the nonprofits are well known and trusted. That is a concern of ours, is getting homeowners to want to apply for this program, but we do think that there are some opportunities for partnership that we're going to be exploring with our nonprofit partners. So, thank you.
Who's got another question? I can't
wait. He must have been in the meetings with him before.
Oh, Bryson. One of the largest issues we have in Nashville is acquisition plans. So I see that, of course, you got the home dollars that can go for new construction. Mm-hmm. And there's 50, you guys want to do 50 the first year, which kind of brings down to like $40,000 per unit. Mm-hmm. Will there be any funds available, like say through the CBDG funds, to do acquisition of land in targeted areas?
We don't have any proposed for CDBG because of CDBG's prohibition on new construction, and you can't land bank with CDBG. It's a very hard thing to do unless you're doing it for a public project, like an infrastructure or you're clearing something of some light, which we don't have in this plan. Again, if you have something specific in mind and want to submit a comment for us to consider, or even consider next year with our programming, on what you would use that for. Is it acquisition of vacant land or acquisition of existing housing?
Yeah, I will give you an example. Like, I was going through that, we were doing a project over there in the exact same area, and I noticed there are still lots where I see foundations that were built to build two units, and the contractor either lost the funding or something happened, and it's just sitting there vacant, half built. So there's still a possibility of acquiring something and putting four lines in there. It's just the pricing is the issue. Now,
yeah,
you can get it cheap, but now it's like, you know, everyone's a fortune.
And that's the thing is do we have enough CDBG to be able to assist with that acquisition?
maybe like a leverage story. You know, what we do is we always leverage funds with other farms and teach you and that sort of thing. So not do the entire acquisition, but maybe part of the leverage.
And an acquisition is an eligible expense in home for the new home construction.
Right.
So if you receive home money for acquisition and new construction, okay, and that can work together.
I work for affordable housing as a family developer, but you're triggering thoughts about single family, and especially when you're talking about the neighborhoods you're not in that area. Are there initiatives in place to like ease property taxes for at-risk homeowners in the area?
Metro government has a couple of tax relief programs. I think they're for elderly or they offer elderly or
elderly.
Yeah. And so they tried aggressively during the reappraisal process to market that, but that's the only thing that I know of. We can't fund anything like that with our federal funds.
What about something like a single family pilot program?
Can you describe more of what you're thinking?
So for one of the properties that we developed, we received a 10-year pilot program in lieu of taxes.
Right.
So it kept the property tax rate at the existing rate before we developed it. So when it reappraises in 2 years, then it would be a rate. But
yeah.
So something similar for single family homes that would qualify for this property tax reasons.
Those things are state law issues, and we'll certainly take that comment and summarize it and communicate it back to our Metro colleagues and let them know that that was a comment that we received and a concern.
More of a question.
Yeah. I can't speak to that because, again, we just got the authority 2 years ago to do the pilots for low-income housing tax credits, which is a state law initiative. So it would have to be something that first the state law may have to enable for Metro, and certainly it's a Metro Council, not an MDHA, but we will reflect your comment about wanting that explored, or wondering if that could be explored, and share that with our colleagues.
Yes.
Is there any funding for assistant Section 8 voucher holders to maybe buy a house?
So I know the Section 8 program has their self-sufficiency program that does help on the pathway to home ownership.
Yeah, that's only for people who can work. I'm disabled.
Okay.
So, you know, if I speak, you know, for elderly who, you know, people who are disabled.
Right.
Want to own a home, living off a disability, which is a very low income, to be able to buy a home, you know.
We don't have funding proposed in this program. We have some partners in the city, like the Housing Fund, that provide down payment assistance. The Tennessee Housing Development Agency has some affordable homeownership options. We can certainly take your name and provide it to our partner agencies, and maybe they can reach out to you and give you some information.
You covered this earlier, but maybe I just kind of missed it. Back on the market analysis. what is the reason why that particular AMI group is?
Okay. So you're on that big, mm-hmm. no, that,
see,
not,
not
that one.
That.
Okay. Home rental is at 60. That's a programmatic regulation.
Okay.
That's from HUD.
Okay.
Our pilot authority, paid in lieu of tax, is one of these that was mentioned, is can only be coupled with low income housing tax credits, which, as you know, only 60% are below.
Correct.
The trust funds, which are the National Housing Trust Fund from the federal government, I think is at 30%. If not, it's definitely 60. And then locally, policy reasons, the Barnes Fund and the State Housing Trust Fund, also at 60 for rental. And again, that's because that's where we see the housing need the most. Also, homeownership regulations cap it at 80% for home. Barnes Fund, of course, that's a council, local government decision, but that's where they decided to go. When Barnes initially rolled out, it was capitalized with home money, so it followed the home rules.
Correct.
So those are regulatory driven, and home is 80% for homeownership.
Okay.
And any CDBG is at 80%. And then, of course, NSP is HUD, and that's at up to 120. So a lot of that is really totally regulation driven.
Okay. I figured, I just wasn't sure. Yeah, because I remember years ago, HUD used to allow, used to be 80% of AMI. You guys were 80% as well. So I see that gap now. 60 below, then you go to 120, but that group between 60 and 80 is getting kind of lost.
Right, and that's actually why I showed this. Because there's a space for banks, the CRA and your CDFI.
CIPC.
Yeah.
That's 80%.
There's some private, so hopefully, again, this is a great tool to take around and say, hey, there's space.
Right.
Because we hear from our lenders, we hear from funding partners. Well, how can we support this? And when we can actually show gaps where we need that supplementation, because this, when you get to, especially between 60 and 120, we're talking workforce.
Correct.
And there's a huge gap because there's not much subsidy there to assist with those buildings. And so that's why it's either subsidized
unit or your market rates. Yeah. Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah, sure, Mark.
I hate to dominate the
floor. No, you're fine. I'm glad to answer questions.
I guess we don't know, but the RAP program,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty much converting all the public housing. How's that going? Is that going to have any effect on, because I know one of the concentration areas is Napier Sioux.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have any correlation with what is going on with home, or is that just totally separate, or you guys just concentrate in that area because you're revitalizing RAD with a, I guess I'm trying to say it, because all those people in the public housing, okay, when RAD comes along, what is the percentage of individuals that would be brought back into those units?
Okay. So RAD actually requires a one-for-one physical replacement of a unit.
Okay.
And no change in history.
Okay.
Like six.
Right.
Not six.
Okay.
So everyone has, our intent is to build a building. Vacant land nearby, and then
okay.
from that building into the new building.
Okay.
The best, there might have to be an interim.
That's all I was trying
yeah.
to figure out. Yeah.
But yeah, the requirement is the one for one absolute replacement.
Okay.
That funding is separate from
RAD is not funding. RAD is not a funding stream from HUD. What it is that under the public housing model, where we receive annual, what's called an annual contribution contract from HUD, which is the administration does is that we no longer get those things from HUD.
Right.
Now what we have is what's called a project-based rental assistance contract with HUD, where we get the subsidy from the federal government. Tenants still pay whatever they were paying before. And but HUD releases their deed of trust. Because all the public housing is on a deed of trust. You can't take a loan out against it. You can't leverage it.
Right.
So what this does is it puts us in the realm of a private developer and able to obtain the equity and finance and build new. And so there's not a funding stream with RAD. It's just however we can leverage funds to build. And so we react pretty much like a private lender in that regard, but we still have our very low income.
So you will need additional units probably. That's a lot of displacement to revamp those units and move one for one.
So yeah. It's not a scrape
okay.
the whole site
okay,
type
so
of project at
house.
All.
Okay.
If you've been to Casey
right.
and see what, so
yeah,
same
all the,
thing.
Okay, same.
So we have vacant land on the perimeter of Casey. We've got Patrick Park that's underway. But that's mixed income. That's some PBRA contracts, so people move from existing Casey units into there. We've got some workforce housing and some market rate.
Okay.
And then we broke ground on our second one, which is a tax credit mixed income. So there'll be some PBRA units there, some people will move into those.
Okay.
As we empty out the buildings that are occupied, we can tear those down and build another one in its place. But so far, nothing has come down, but we're coming
right.
up on vacant land.
Okay.
And so it's not at all like, again, hope six memories run deep in this.
I know it's
and
yeah.
it's not voucher people out and then tear down everything and then rebuild and everybody comes back. It's not that
okay.
at all.
Okay.
Yes,
I want to make reference to Appendix G and Appendix G it says Appendix A. Vision Napier's Citizen Choice Neighborhoods Transformation Plan RAP, and basically it's empty. And it's saying true with Appendix B and C. This is what I downloaded, I believe, on your website. So.
Our website has all of our appendices. It's a separate,
yeah, it's separate link.
It's a separate link on our website that all of our appendices are available online.
Yeah, I got some of the appendices, but I'm just saying on Appendix G. It doesn't relate to the consolidated plan.
The Appendix G is the, I believe it in our section on geographic priorities where we lay out the Napier-Suicum Choice Neighborhood Planning Area. We refer to Appendix G, that's what that is, because we're also, as we discussed,
well, that's what
submitting
I show on SP6. SP6 says see Appendix G. Pursuitican and my Appendix G right here it's Appendix G and then Appendix A and this is all here.
Okay,
it's,
well,
it's blank.
Well, we
and
will.
Then it has B and C and they're blank also.
I Nonsa, are you on our website?
I'm checking.
Yeah, Nonsa's going to check our website because those appendices are fully loaded and available. If not, we will check the link that it did break once. And someone let me know that. If not, we can give you, we'll print them out for you if you want to pick up the hard mm-hmm. copy, but they're on our website.
Well, I just got what I downloaded, and that was
okay.
it. So.
Well, we will check that out. Thank you for letting us know. It's been a day of technical difficulties.
Well, I just wanted to follow up, too, on the stuff when you had on SB 10, the strategic plan. You have housing target areas with 14 council districts. I can refer to the ones that are here in the room here on page 5 on the top frame there.
Mm-hmm.
You've got 14 council districts, and they're the ones that had at least a 40% increase in property values. I don't understand why they would be a target area. If you have property values that are increasing dramatically, they're doing pretty good.
Well,
don't understand why you'd call that a housing target area.
It's an anti-displacement initiative. One of the things that we've heard repeatedly in these areas where property values Consolidated Plan, egregious, absolutely egregious stories. Because what's happening are developers come into these areas and building new bright and shiny things, and the homeowners there cannot afford to make the repairs to stay in their homes, and so they're being pressured to sell. And so we heard a lot of conversations about what can we do to help people stay in their homes. So that is a specific anti-displacement strategy to keep people in their housing.
Well, what you have here, it says housing preservation and new housing construction.
Right. We also want to, again, if an area is gentrifying, it means it's losing affordable housing. I mean,
right.
So we want to make sure that people have housing choice in these areas. I mean, we certainly, if housing properties are rising, that means there's opportunities coming in. So we want to make sure that there are affordable housing options in these areas that are getting more and more opportunities brought into them, because that's another thing that we've heard repeatedly, a criticism about affordable housing development in Nashville. It's being pushed to areas, consistently being concentrated in areas that are low income. So we want to be very intentional on siting affordable housing in areas that are seeing a lot of development and revitalization.
Well, when you say housing preservation, are you talking about rehab?
Yes, that's what housing preservation is.
Could you tell me what the appendix C was that you didn't have?
G? Appendix was number G, and it had a thing related to silicon, and some of the stuff doesn't reference as far as it's kind of Hancock, but there's stuff that was blank in my copy that I got as far as on. I mean, I can show you. I just got what I printed out, and it was just,
okay.
Like I said,
well,
it's right here. I'll show
it
you.
It appears that there's been some technical difficulty somewhere. We're glad to resolve it, and I can bring it to the Homeless Commission meeting tomorrow.
That would be great. Mark, you want to take it? I have more questions, but I just...
You
want
to defer to me for a second?
Oh,
for
I
your
just
time.
Thought you had a lot of questions, and I'm interested in what you have to say. So just
well, actually, I only have one more question. This is actually my final question. Is there any funding from the previous 5 years just coming to the new 5-year consolidated plan?
No.
Or is it all? Okay.
We are wrapping up.
Okay.
We officially, because we have such different and new priorities, and so we're wrapping up those older programs. Now, some of them are we do
still
have some,
yeah.
But we're not carrying forward.
Okay.
Keep those and lock those down. And the plan that expires.
Right.
And then I'll go back to ES3, and it said the second paragraph, more information about each activity is available in section AP 35, and that's around this because that's there's nothing there that refers to that.
AP
35 only has a few sentences on it.
Thank you for pointing that out, Steve, because there's
at least my copy of our.
No, you're right. I'm gonna tell you why, Steve. And I'll correct that reference because I know what I've done is so the numbers at the bottom are AP dash page number, but we also have sections.
It says section AP dash 35. So you're the one.
So it's referring to the section, but if it's easier, I will incorporate your comment and change that reference to the page number. And not the section, because you actually have to dive in and look at the section headings. So I'll make that correction, but I'm referring to, Steve, starting on page AP 11. That's where we start listing our projects. And so AP 11 through... AP 11 through AP 33 pages, that's where we detail our proposals.
second paragraph, okay. Last line. Community development block grant, don't know when we have. It says housing target areas, preference will be given to projects located in the housing target areas, but assistance may be provided countywide if there's not sufficient interest in housing target areas. And then it doesn't tell what housing target areas, but on the next page it says location description, Metro Council districts experience high housing costs due to increased property values. So, I guess that's confusing to me.
Okay, so we define.
I don't understand where you're. When the other section here says housing target areas, and it's not defined, and then the other one said, on the next page, it says location description, housing, Metro Council districts experiencing health.
So, we actually define our target areas in the strategic plan, but for ease of reference, I am happy to go back into these sections and add the page number where you can see where we define what the housing target areas are. We define that in.
Those maps actually.
Yeah, SP10 is where we start the definition of the housing target areas. But we will add those references in our projects so that. If you miss that section and are just looking at the action plan, you know where you can find it.
I love maps.
Yeah, the maps. I'm going to tell you, our map person was Tenotswa. We are loaded with maps in our action plan.
I'm kind of impressed by the maps this time.
I'm pretty good at maps. Another comment on needs analysis. This needs assessment is page 40, and you refer to MDHA has allowed 1,400 of those housing choice vouchers to be used as project-based vouchers. I think you should incorporate the numbers on the waiting list so it shows that need there that people are really looking for housing.
Oh, you want us to talk about our waiting lists. Okay, yeah.
I'd like to see a reference to
that. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point.
In the consolidated plan about the timetable for creating UTOB districts. I know MDHA has the authority to create those districts in this 5 years. It's a long time. So I'm just thinking of ways that you could connect people to opportunities along this high class.
We only refer as a few references to the proposed TOD in Donaldson. Because that is the only one that is known. The city has not identified or announced where the other areas are. So as we do each annual update, if there is a known TOD that's proposed, we will certainly include it. But for our home program, one of our evaluation factors is proximity to corridors. And so we try to drive that anyway through our funding. But right now, the only one that is
so it's the city that creates the district, and not
community. Well, it's a collaboration. I mean, we have the redevelopment authority, but it's a collaboration on where these are going. And after the referendum discussion, I think they're going to revisit any of that.
Gotcha. Is there any interest to when that discussion will commence?
That is a different wheelhouse for me. Okay. So I'm not aware of any discussions.
I just know that Nashville Next and In Motion have both brought to light the Tier 1 centers, and those are still exist without the transit plan. So,
right.
If we know where those districts could go in theory, it seems like we could also begin planning as to what could go there.
This is on SB 9, second paragraph. It refers to the NRSA application submitted with the consolidated plan. Could I get a copy of that?
That's Appendix G.
That's where I had the problem with Appendix G.
I'm going to give it to you tomorrow.
Can I get the one, too, that's on the other one that I didn't get? I'll refer to that later before you go.
We're going to give you the whole appendices packet, all appendices that you said you didn't. You said none of the appendices printed for you?
Oh, they did. No, I got some, but I'm just saying Appendix G and the stuff that was in there, it was didn't correlate because it had the market study, everything for Newcomb Safety, Napier Sudicum.
Right, yeah.
But
okay.
It just had, this is the draft, but there was nothing there. And so what I'm saying is that...
Are you saying there's nothing there and that it's blank? Or it's not telling you what you something you want to know?
Yeah, it just says, it just has basically saying this is the study, and there's nothing there. It's just, you know, it's just the headline, basically.
Oh, okay.
It's
like
a blank page.
Yeah, it's blank pages. Okay, all right. Just making sure we're on the same blank page.
Yeah,
it's just... Now, you know, when I downloaded it was maybe different, and maybe they did something different, but I'm just saying,
okay.
My copy, I just want.
Okay.
You know, mine's
all
right.
So
that's an
easy
fix.
You just need Appendix G.
Well, just do the whole thing, because
okay,
it makes
cool.
It easier, because I don't
know.
Yeah,
in case you had some kind of other glitches that you haven't picked up about with the download,
yeah.
We'll print the whole thing. It'd
be a lot easier for me
yeah.
That way, because then I could go out and say, see, what you say you got worked out, because mine was all messed up.
Okay.
I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing, I guess, is on the home. You're going to do 75% basically for rental, right? And 25% for home?
70% for rental.
70%
for home. And 20% for homeowner, and then 10% for admin. That's
100%. Okay. Well, what I read in the appendix, because you have the enforcement to me, that is really kind of problematic, because I can think some person could go out there and have that, and then just say, hey, go out and sell it. I just don't know. There's some jurisdictions where they go out and they just sell it, and it's like, hey, they're messed up. And some can use it as Airbnb and all sorts of other things. I really, have you experienced any sort of enforcement action against somebody who was non-compliant with their home as far as when they wanted to sell it, and they couldn't get a low-income person, so they were kind of stuck, and then they just sold it anyhow, or you had to do some enforcement, or you waived some provisions?
So we have reported restrictions that if...
As well as a deed of trust.
Yeah, deed of trust.
10 years.
So, for new construction, yeah. So if the title company's doing their job, and the lender's doing their job, they've done a title search, and they've picked up on our restriction. And we make a whole lot of homeowners mad because they've now are ready to flip that house and make twice as much as on it than they paid for it, and then they find out they can't do that. And we will not release that deed of trust. If it's a resale provision, we will not release it. They have to sell it. I mean, period. Or I mean,
well,
or they pay us back what they owe us, and we will use it to create new affordable housing.
See, that's where I get confused. Is because somebody goes out and wants to sell it, and they have to notify you because they have this restriction on there, and then it's up to them to find the low-income eligible person.
Well, that's what they agreed to when they bought the house.
Yeah, I know, but I just don't see how they go out and do that, because you just go out there and somebody just calls a realtor and says, I want to sell, here's my price. And so they go out there and somebody unwittingly just says, hey, in the marketplace the way it is today, people just go out there and say, I want that. That's a good price, because you're going to price it cheaper, because you're going to figure they're not going to do their due diligence. Somebody goes, hey, I'll sign a contract for that. And so I was just wondering, because this had to come up at some point in time within the legal department, where somebody goes out there and, you know, they might even do it on a contract for deed or something else. I mean, I don't know how they would structure the transaction. But what I'm saying is somebody's going to go out there and find a way to say, I'm going to get around that restriction. And because I just don't see, I watch a lot of stuff in terms of real estate transactions. I see very few people that's ever enforced a deed restriction.
I think I kind of see what Steve's talking about. I know the rental side is more, is a lot more monitoring, but I guess you're seeing like on the homeowner side.
Yeah.
It's a little, I guess it's a little different because you have someone that's actually purchased.
But on the homeowner side, we also monitor them annually throughout the affordability period. So they have to prove to us that they're still living in that property by supplying us documents to state that. Light bills, electricity bills, proof of insurance. We have to make sure the taxes are paid. We monitor this annually with all of our homeowners. Now, if they decide in the past how a home has worked, yes, we've done recapture where they can actually sell their property to anyone. It doesn't have to be another low-income person, but they will have to repay the subsidy that we provided them.
Well, that's the thing that's kind of confusing, too, because there is a way out there saying, okay, well, you're saying that that person has to have a reasonable rate of return, which is undefined. So, I mean, anybody,
well,
valuation issues.
I think we clarified that as well this year.
So I look at that and say, wait a minute. I just think it gets problematic as far as the enforcement issue. I think it's really difficult to do. And so I guess I'm asking, what is the cap on that? Because I've seen up to $40,000, and that would be a 15-year. There's a cap.
Well, we have typically have not put more than $14,999 to keep it at a five-year restriction.
Years. You're doing 5 years.
Right.
Okay.
Because the
long-term. That makes more sense.
Yeah.
That makes more sense as far as enforcement. There is a provision in there that basically says also, though, that they could go out there and, if I'm understanding that correctly, that the new buyer could get a subsidy. So the person goes out there and says, okay, well, I want a reasonable rate of return, but this person's a low-income buyer, but they can't afford it, they can't qualify. But they could go out and make an application for some home funding, and then they go out, okay, if you get that there, that helps you with your down payment, then you can qualify. So
you're talking about that, you're talking about like initial purchase or them purchasing?
No, I'm saying,
person?
No, what I'm saying is
in our document, you've read that?
We're talking about how they could get around it.
No. I'm just saying there's availability of home funds. So for instance, let's just say I'm a low-income person. I go out and buy home property, and I just say I want to sell after 3 years. I don't like the neighborhood or whatever else, or I lost my job and I don't want to have a foreclosure. Like, hey, you know, I'm like, maybe a foreclosure basically waives those restrictions. I don't know, but I just go out there and I contact Angie, whoever the contact person is, and say, hey, I can't make my payments. I got a problem. And I want to sell this thing because I want to go in default. I want to reduce my credit rating or anything else. And so my understanding is that they would go out there and say, well, we can probably identify another low-income person. And that low-income person, I say, well, I want a reasonable rate of return. I've seen the prices in my neighborhood skyrocket. So I want between a 12 and 15% rate of return on basically what my investment. And so, but the other person that MDHA probably gets to recruit or housing trust fund or whoever else says, well, this person really loves that piece of property, but they can't meet your price. But in order to meet your price, MDHA will go out and release funds from the home fund to go out to help them with their down payment that I can get out of my situation and that other person.
That is not a proposed use of home funds for down payment assistance standalone.
I wouldn't say the down payment assistance. I would say that you're entitled to get some home funds to be able to buy down, because I think points would be.
The only time down payment assistance is made available is the initial purchase.
Right.
Period.
Right.
They're not on a. So
you may have us confused with the Barnes, because their restrictions actually do.
Yeah.
Say that they have to find another qualified home buyer.
But
okay, here's what I got. This is nature. The seller must have a sales price approved by MDHA. Okay, so if I want a rate of return and I say, hey, you know, I want this, and MDHA says no, we're gonna give you that. And it goes on to say here, the resale price necessary to provide a fair return to the seller is not affordable to the subsequent lower income home buyer, MDHA may provide additional home assistance if available. If additional home assistance is provided, the affordability period will start over. So given what this document says here, is that the scenario that I'm talking about maybe wouldn't be down payment assistance, but it said MDHA may provide additional home assistance.
So, okay, so what we'll do is we'll clarify.
And
the thing was, if available.
Yeah, and I think that's more the language to actually pair with Barnes.
Yeah.
If we have a project where we have home and Barnes. And
but it's also, it has to be an activity in the action plan.
Could you also transfer the initial subsidy that's put into the house to the next person? So like they sold it and say it was $14,900 put in there. They said, well, that $14,900 will remain in the house, but it's going to go to the next person who purchases the house.
No signing.
Yeah, signing the.
I don't know about that. Angie, if you want to touch on that, I don't know.
I'm just trying to think. Maybe that's.
I need to
clarify in that because what the if available means that if we've got it as an activity in our action plan, because we can't use home funds unless we have it in a way that's written in our action plan. So I'll add that language if home funds are available through the action plan as an eligible activity.
It's typically an individual buying the home from a nonprofit that has built the home with home dollars.
Right.
So those funds are coming, they're applying, but those funds are coming from the nonprofit that has applied and got the grant. So that person is purchasing the second time wouldn't be able to actually apply for home dollars because they're not a nonprofit. Sounds confusing.
I don't think an individual could actually apply for home dollars.
Yeah.
And that's the qualifying term, if available.
Right.
So for example, in 2018, you see we don't have like any kind of buy down, down payment assistance, standalone.
Correct.
It's part of that. The home ownership.
Well, my thing is, The program design is that if MDHA has to approve, we just can't have a meeting of the minds and agree on that. You know, and I want out. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to do an Airbnb. I'm going to do something. I mean, I'm going to figure out how I'm going to go out to pay that mortgage.
Well, you know, we get monitored by HUD. We monitor our programs. We're glad for you to raise your concerns. We monitor this very diligently. We haven't had any issues that I know of. Airbnb, but we're glad to take your concern on how we can increase our monitoring to make sure that people are using.
Well, I guess my thing is really program design. I think it comes down to that. So I think the way it's probably structured right now is a little bit problematic because I'm looking, if I would have to enforce something or if I'm doing that program the way I see it designed here, I wouldn't want to do it like that. I think it causes misunderstandings between everybody.
We're following HUD's whole guidance on resale. We have to do either resale or recapture as HUD defines it, and we have to include it in our action plan how we do it, and that's what we're doing. And HUD has to sign. Actually, they have to sign off on our recapture or resale provisions that are in the appendix. So, anybody else have any comments?
I'll have more, but somebody just picked up some time so they can. I'm going to go through some of this stuff there. I got a ton of paperwork here. I feel like I'm back in college again.
Yes, ma'am.
Does community development have anything to do with how close the new builders are building?
No, ma'am. That's with the codes department.
Oh, okay.
That's a good question. I want to kind of follow your question with the sidewalks.
Yeah.
So you guys are in the CBDD funds, because that's a big issue all around town, building new sidewalks and the new law. So you put money, I know it wasn't a ton of money because sidewalks are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically trying to, if you're developing a piece of property in one of the census tracts, you're trying to just really connect where there are bus lines and maybe there's not a sidewalk at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so.
Or it's not ADA, there's no sidewalk, especially if there's elderly or living in that area. Yeah.
Would it be tied into like a development, like a nonprofit doing development in that area, or just the neighborhood themselves apply for that grant?
No, we it's not a neighborhood application thing. We'll be working with our with planning and public works.
Oh, okay.
And looking and seeing, okay, where are you getting a lot of requests? Where are you seeing these things that are needed? And what we hear from the community. We've had a lot of, you know, we've had area people tell us specific areas of town, Antioch, Bordeaux, North Nashville, that need these things. So we'll be looking to say, okay, we have a budget of this.
Okay.
Is there a project that can make an impact in somewhere that...
I know it's bad, but the street's falling off. It's really bad. But that's cool. I like that. It's pretty good.
Yeah, that's the coast department.
Yeah, because they're not leaving any room for expansion on the highways, you know. They build right next to the street, right next to the sidewalk, so there's no room for...
Yeah, the new sidewalk
streets.
Is even worse because now you get, before you had a little more frontage, but the new sidewalk law is a 4-foot vegetation strip in a 5-foot sidewalk. So before you have the 5-foot sidewalk, they have more frontage. So now that's encroaching more.
But now they're not allowing any room for the streets to be widened or anything, you know.
Right.
So where are they going to go now that the population is getting so heavy? Are they going to widen the streets?
Oh, to widen the streets. Okay, I see what you're talking about. Yeah. Oh, yeah, because they're building the houses so close to the sidewalk and the street, there's no way for them to widen.
There's no way to go.
Any more comments?
Just okay on the stuff on the home there, on the new construction for the rental. That's incomes after below 60% EMI, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. So, if we have, you're planning to do the majority of them in rental and not home ownership. So it should not. How many? I guess after checking, how many were you planning to do in the program here?
50 rentals.
50 rental? How many of home ownership though?
Five and two. Let me get to that slide. Five.
Okay. Gotcha. And then the other thing I just reiterate this, and that is that I'm assembling programs and the opportunity now program. Those are things that really should be funded by Metro government. We've had the summer youth program for quite a while. It's only like 6 to 8 weeks and covers parks and everything else. I really think that should be, at this point in time, funded by Metro government. I just don't understand why we're constantly using federal dollars for something like that. And to follow up on what Mark was saying on sidewalks, I think that should be directed to public works. I don't think we should be allocating federal money for sidewalks.
Okay, well,
there's so many great needs that are there, but that's just not something that I think is.
We will reflect your comment.
Maybe it's for public works to do more.
Well, as you were pointing out, you said that sidewalks are expensive, and I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I really think that that's something that. You know, infrastructure things, I think that's what we have capital improvement budget for.
Yeah.
And a capital spending plan. And so if you're a district council member, you go out there and say, if I want a sidewalk on that street, then that's something I go in there. I put it in there with the planning department and say, this is what I would like. I don't think somebody should have to come out and do a consolidated plan and say, oh, we want to be in a choice neighborhood grant or whatever else, put some sidewalks out there. I think housing should be your focus, not an unhousing thing. And so I think that revitalization is good, but the opportunity for housing dollars is so small that I think your action plans really should focus on that. And also, I guess this is the G or whatever else, PR9, and it says the COC received a renewable grant to create 3 CES coordinators. What was that renewable grant?
That was through COC fund, I think $120,000, something like that. I don't have it exactly in mind yet, for a grant. That's the one three workers are hired at OASIS, OSD, and St. Peter to work together on the CES action, and then we can go into it. And that's the one where we're looking to come in kind of restructure that and get it all under one umbrella.
Okay, so you're saying
it's actually just St. Peter.
So Safe Haven got the grant, and then was sub-recipient to the other. But
we're
renewable
that
grant,
right,
what
now.
Grant was that? It says
it
renewable.
It was a COC. So I'm looking at
right, just the continuum of care competition.
I just don't understand the terminology of renewable grant.
That's a HUD terminology on the COC competition.
Yeah.
It's either a new project or it's renewable, and that's you received it in the past and you're applying for it again. Is that right, Susie?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we have talks about, you know, 18 housing choice vouchers for people experiencing rural homelessness. We have a pause on that right now. What's the status of that?
I cannot speak to it because I don't administer that program, but I'll be glad to get an update from the director of rural assistance.
Okay. The other thing I brought to the attention earlier today was when housing navigators are trained by Metro Homeless Commission staff are required to utilize coordinated entry system to apply for move-in costs. And that is a little bit problematic to me because it is an option if they want to be allowed to participate in CES. And they should be entitled to federal money because that is not a federal program requirement.
I believe our HUD folks today clearly said we could add that requirement and work.
I believe that was erroneous on that. I don't believe that is correct.
That
but
HUD
I know. But I'm bringing that here because
okay.
I needed
yeah.
to do that concern.
Yes,
and
absolutely. It'll be reflected in the record, but.
It's
PR9
is what
yes,
I referred to
yes,
in the
absolutely.
Thing there. Okay. Because I think that constitutes a denial of service. And if that is something, then that has to be a policies and procedures change, because that to me constitutes a denial of service. Also then, just to go on HMIS lead, the process for that I thought was faulty, so there was no referral to the HMIS Advisory Committee, and it makes reference here in page ER11. The HMIS Committee serves as advisory and oversight body to the COC and HMIS lead. Its primary purpose is to provide guidance to the COC and HMIS lead on planning, policy development, systems improvement, including regular data quality review to ensure administration of HMIS in accordance with HUD guidelines. I don't believe we're in compliance with that, and I just want the record to reflect that.
Okay, thank you.
Also, given this, as Judy's going to be taking over that assignment, we do have concerns on security and data privacy, and those will be addressed, I think, with that, so you know, some policies and procedures. It's been on outreach here. There's a lot of outreach that basically refers, what I call not outreach, but inreach, refers to metro departments. I don't believe outreach really qualifies for the Parks Department and the Health
okay.
Department or anything else. I think that's inreach.
Okay.
And some of the other things that are in here. What I look at and I think HUD should look at is the people here like tonight or just individuals that are here. I think that when you have interested parties, affordable housing developers that have questions about the consolidated plan, but I don't think some departments that briefing them on some of this stuff is just not, it's not productive time. The other thing here on Vanderbilt University, page BR31, Vanderbilt University was briefed on some stuff, and it says, agency participated in consultation on homelessness with housing navigators. Health and Human Services tracked, prepares students for careers in social work, medical and dental fields, health policy, etc.
That section is just, we have to simply list people or organizations that participated in stakeholder consultations, do a brief description of some of the things they do, and that is simply a reflection of that requirement.
Well, I guess, and this is a thing we'll have
to come up with. And we're certainly not going to exclude any organization from participating in a stakeholder consultation.
I'm not doing that. I guess, you know, my thing is if they're doing things with housing navigators and they're basically saying they're doing outreach, the question comes in whether they're doing entering data in HMIS. And the only thing that I'm aware of is somebody who's going through the psych department and doing that and calling those people patients, if you will, which to me, there's a doctor-patient relationship that's established when somebody is identified. When somebody stops at a homeless camp and says, hey, outreach, how you doing, and making assessments of people, that's not proper. That's not how medical stuff is practiced. Now, they make referrals and say, you can come and visit.
I'm glad to direct you to the contact at Vanderbilt. I'm simply reflected that they attended a meeting.
Correct.
And a description of some of the things. I'm not making a judgment call on what they do.
Well, that to me was more than just, that raises some issues, and I've seen that happen in some other jurisdictions where they're doing that, but that's, I don't believe that's, I'm going to bring that up with some people at the American Psychiatric Association. I don't believe that's proper how you're doing it. How they're doing it, that has no reflection on you. That's something that raises all sorts of issues. The other thing I wanted to, just to reinforce on that, and that is, I just have bought this from Judy, and I'll see you tomorrow on some stuff. On your stuff, it may be through HMIS or CES, the number of chronic homeless people that you housed in the last year, just that. I'm not asking for, and I guess if you participated, those 18 housing choice vouchers, they went through the homeless description, correct?
We are, we're not getting the vouchers. They're still coming from NPHA.
I know you're not getting them out, but you were getting 18, correct? Or was that you were getting 18?
We're looking at the applications and making sure that they're filled out and forwarding them to NHA. So it's we're kind of a middleman run through to make sure their right applications are handed over.
18 housing choice vouchers are set aside to get referrals from the Metro Homelessness Commission. The Rental Assistance Department still reviews the housing choice voucher applications based on the referrals. The housing choice voucher program is still administered by NDHA. They just set aside 18 for referrals from New Mexico State.
But those are a preference or set aside?
They're a set aside or a preference for
yes.
them. There's a, yeah, they're, well, they're 18 preference, but that's what it means. Preference set aside.
And those are. When did the 18 number, maybe you can answer that, stop? It was, we haven't had 18 for at least this month, maybe last month.
Again, I'll have to get information from our rental assistance director. I don't know those details.
Well, then you get the stuff tomorrow on that Envision Napier and Sudafin, whatever it was,
yes.
on the stuff on that.
We're going to print the entire appendices and exhibits section for you.
Well, I just didn't know what was referring to that. If the copy that I got mixed up with something else, but I would like to have what they considered a transformation plan.
Right. Yes.
And this was, there's Envision Napier and Sudafin. I don't know which are which. I just.
So to clarify, we received a Choice Neighborhoods planning grant
correct.
For that whole boundary. Map that's in our target area, and the grant requires that actually this month we produce a transformation plan, which is new housing, new neighborhood amenities, and a people plan for how the residents will have access to certain kinds of services. So the transformation plan is a choice neighborhoods terminology, which is like a redevelopment plan. That's what they call it.
How many pages is roughly that?
I have no idea. But again, well, that's what the appendix is.
Okay. On page NA44, this refers to the emergency shelter bed occupancy rate during extreme cold weather. 23 nights that are listed that are here. I think the problem is, because we're talking about actual bed utilization, the utilization rate was not as high as it should have been or could have been. And I think there should be some reference in there that homeless people don't know that there is going to be something open for them. So to go out and to say on December 7th and maybe at 5 o'clock that day, they're told, oh, it's going to be cold out, so we're going to have some people that are going to the fairgrounds or some other spots. The communication to the homeless community is really bad. And that's the reason that the numbers are reflected here. So when HUD looks at those and going like, you know, they must be doing okay. They've got plenty of beds over there. But those numbers really mischaracterize what we have going on in Nashville. Because I can guarantee you that if we had a plan and it was going to be cold, and somebody would call Judy at 12 o'clock in that afternoon and said, geez, I don't want to stay on the street tonight. Can I go out and reserve a bed at one of your spots? You would have not 79.2% on December 7th. You would have 120%, guaranteed.
So just for clarification, that table is just prepared by the Metro Homelessness Commission just to reflect what their statistics were on cold weather nights. That's not our utilization rate.
No, I know. I know, but it says basically there were 23 nights that, because the plan is for 25 degrees or less. I just want, for people in the room here that don't understand, it's not 32, it's 25, which is really, really cold, okay? You don't want to be out at 25 degrees when it's that cold. You don't want to be out there at 32 degrees. But my point is, when HUD looks at this and says, geez, on December 7th, it said 79.2%. Then on December 8th, it says 77.7%. On December 9th, it says 80.5%. And that just mischaracterized what we have in Nashville. We have plenty of people that would love to be able to go out and say, it's really cold out there, but I don't know if I'm going to be stuck sitting in a mission in a chair for 8 hours. Maybe I should just stay, you know, bundle it with my tent and have my propane. It's probably better there. If people could call in and say at 12 o'clock and say, look, I want to come on in, but I want to make sure that I'm not going to sit in the chair. I want to find out where I'm going to go. Everybody in this room knows where they're going to go at 12 o'clock. Got a pretty good idea. Almost people don't. They got to figure out where they're going to go and how they're going to survive. Fundamental. And so when these statistics are put in this plan here, just totally mischaracterizes the situation that homeless people this town face. And I find it really problematic, to say the least, that the utilization rate, and this is going to be coming to HUD, and they're going to look at this, and they're going to say, oh, geez, you know. And that's not the case at all. In fact, we have people die during those days in December and January because they freeze to death. And that, to me, is inexcusable. But when HUD looks at this going, well, everybody must be housed. They're doing good. It's not true. It's not true.
And one clarification point, that chart does not include the chairs. That's just based on the beds.
I'm not
arguing with anything else. I just wanted that.
Well, I'm sorry. You can't go out there and have a cold weather plan at 25 degrees. That's, to me, number one. That's just hypothermia sets in a lot quicker than that. The other point is that if you're going to go out and put a note out there at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, oh, here's a press release and here's the thing to the media. You can go out there and you can go to Hadley Park or East Park. I'm sorry, homeless people don't go walking around with their thing here and have a buzzer that goes off and says, here, this is where, you know, you should go.
they don't have access to TVs. They're walking the streets. You know, they're entitled to know where they should be able to go rather than just wandering around hoping that they might get a place to lie down for the night rather than sitting in a chair all night at the mission. I think they're entitled to that. And that what is written down here is going to be submitted to HUD, to me, sends the wrong message, because that's not true. I think it sends a terrible message, that basically it's going, oh, they got plenty of beds. I mean, homeless people, they're doing good. I mean, they got plenty of beds there. And that's not true. There were over 100 people that were at the fairgrounds this year. And it was cold. And then they got booted out at 8 o'clock in the morning, went to a room at the inn, and there was 300, 400 people there. And they had to leave because there were just, the fire marshal would come in there and just say, so there are people wandering around town. Okay. Wandering around town with no place to go.
We're clear that we need to reflect the comments of the utilization rate in that table on NA44.
Well, I would appreciate that if there was some sort of comment to reflect that this was at 5 o'clock they were told this, and that a person went out and strongly objected to including that chart in there because it sends the wrong message, that if homeless people had an opportunity.
We will reflect your comment on that chart. Do we have any other comments? I want to make sure everyone has an opportunity to be heard.
I just want to follow up on one thing. I did get a copy of this here. It was really good. It was good to see comments that were really reflective. I think some of the comments in here were really good. These are people that came in here and...
For the record, Steve requested a copy of our meeting notes from all of our public input sessions and community meetings that we refer to in our outreach plan. So then you know what he's talking about.
Right.
We kept those on file because they were just too dense to really add to our already...
Well, people have some really good insights
in here.
And, you know, there's a redundancy in homeless services. Facility-based operations needed the highest priority while supportive services should be the lowest. And these are coming from people that, and then I see Daryl Murray did something, and he's referring to recovery housing. Now, recovery housing, he's referring to transitional housing. That's what his program would be, correct? And it is considered not, he couldn't qualify for housing first because he basically has barriers to entry as far as sobriety. So if he wanted to go out and do a permanent housing thing, and said, I want to do permanent housing, but I want to go out and have a sobriety, you know, that people can't drink here, they're not going to get funded. I just wanted to clarify that. Because we're following housing first. Is that correct or is that erroneous?
Are you talking about with home? That is not an issue with home.
I don't know if he's referring, I don't think he's just referring to any
I believe his comment that he emailed in was regarding something particularly to help with the opioid crisis.
Correct, but he basically talked about recovery housing, but if he's going to go out to people who have addiction issues, if he's going to do a housing opportunity for him, he refers to recovery housing.
We evaluate our home applications as we receive them on whether or not they're eligible, and we're not going to make we do have to have permanent housing, I can't make any kind of call on what would be or would not be awarded funding under home until we see an actual request. Now, I can't speak for the consumer care ANOVA process. They find things a little differently, but for home, which is the consolidated plan, we issue an RFP, people propose, and it's evaluated.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Anybody else? Anything else? Mark, are you sitting on something?
No,
come on, Mark. Are you
sure?
Come on, you've been quiet for way too long.
Steve's going to give you the last word.
You must have a question.
No, I pretty much went through. I know a lot of some of the stuff that you do is kind of regulated through the HUD, so you don't have that. I've learned that through the years. Trust me, Steve, when I first started, I was worse than you. Believe that.
I know. Hard time envisioning that.
You should have been around. But I've learned through the years that a lot of stuff is regulated through HUD, so pretty much you are just passing the buck. So I learned to adapt.
Well, I thank you all for your time tonight. Did you have a comment or question, though, before?
Oh, no. Okay.
Your time tonight for accommodating the technical facility issues with the closed parking lot. Giving us your time, your comments. Again, anything in writing, and